time. Thanks so much, Wes, and back to Roy, ACTPO.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff, and thank you as always, Wes. Any other comments on this marvel of electronics that you own?
Yes, I was particularly interested in 137 kilohertz, although the best achievement that was made by ham radio operators was 9.6 or my 9.86 kilohertz, and they have made over 1,000 miles distance communication on that frequency. With the life that we have left, we want to have something that is exciting, and I believe since a few hundred dollars is not a big deal for most of us, we can get a piece of gear that really makes the difference. Jeff, if you want my telephone number, contact a net provider, Net General, right, Dr. Roy, he has my telephone number, so you can call me. Thank you very much, I appreciate the time given to me, and to XJ.
Okay, thank you very much, Wes, and thank you, Jeff. Anyone else with any comments before we move on to something else? Okay, so you're just listening, you don't have a comment.
No.
Oh, well, okay, good to have you here. Listen away, and if something comes to mind, feel free to share it with us. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net, and every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Mon, we do this thing. And so if anyone else has any further questions, we still have about 9 minutes before the usual scheduled SpaceNet report. So if you have any technical questions, amateur radio questions, scientific topics, or general medical questions, please hit that push to talk button.
2SCP, KD2SCP.
Yes, KD2SCP. What can I do you for?
Just basically checking in. I believe you guys are net out on Long Island. I'm located in Yonkers. Everything's good. The weather's nice right now. Nothing storm related yet. Just sitting by listening. Over.
Okay, Lewis, yes, this is the Limark Technical Net, first started under Dick, K2RIW, 1982. Been going strong, and every Sunday night at 8 p.m. we do this. There are archives that go as far back as September of 2006 at amateurradio.tv. So this is just a thing we all do, and I hope that you'll come back and be a regular listener and maybe even participate a bit.
I've got something interesting. I'm sitting here with a brand new MFJ-873 meter right now. My reverse power is not very high. The SWR is about 1.5 or so.
Okay, that sounds good. You should always try and transmit into close to a 1-to-1 impedance matched antenna. Watt meters are our friends. I kind of tell everyone, although obviously the most important thing is getting an antenna and a radio and a microphone. It's always nice to have things like watt meters and visual meters and dummy loads so that you could check your stuff and make sure that you're operating efficiently.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
wanted to ask, the person that checked in about the 873, is that in the Grandmaster models?
Roger, it's the Grandmaster MFJ873, 125 to 525 megahertz. Peak reading SWR watt meter. I just picked it up about 2 days ago from someplace in Jersey through Amazon, and I'm using it, looking at it right now. My power output is exactly 50 watts. The radio is a Wotion quad band, and believe it or not, my antenna is a disc cone, which is why I really wanted the meter to see what it's doing with this radio. Over.
Yeah, well, Grand, in my opinion, Grandmaster, great model meters. Great model SWR power meters from the past. Good luck and have fun with it. One of the best you can buy for the price. It's not going to be up there when other people will tell you, oh, I have this or that, but good luck with that. I have a couple of them. They're great meters. Have fun. Well made, the Grandmaster model is absolutely superb. Back to you, Roy, KD2FIU. Thank you.
Okay, very good, George. Thank you for that. I'm looking up on MFJ's own website. They give a list price of $119.95. You know, some people really hate MFJ, some people really love MFJ. I'm sort of someplace in the middle. They have had an unfortunate history with quality assurance to the point where I still buy their stuff. I tend to shake it, and if I hear anything, even if I don't hear anything, I take the top off and I take a good look inside to make sure there's no cold solder joints and there's no loose nuts or bolts going on. But, you know, they are a major company in amateur radio. They bought out a lot of companies that would have gone out of business when their owners are retired. So it's a mixed bag, but I think there's certainly a great place for MFJ products. I own a bunch of them, but, you know, always be a little on the cautious side, I would suggest.
ACTPL, quick comment.
Yes, Jeff.
Thanks, Roy. ACTPL. Two things. Number one, I just popped you an email. And number two, I was found up on top of a roof installing a beam antenna over in Yonkers. And the people were passing the elements up to me. And I was hooking them up to the boom and put one up and I kind of heard a rattle. I didn't pay much attention and I heard it again and I said, wait a minute. So myself and another guy up on the roof now had them pass up the tools to take the element apart, take the trap out, take the trap apart, and lo and behold, when you tip it up, a screw comes falling out of it.
Pray tell, was this company owned by MFJ, or, you know, I mean, any company is capable of having that little faux pas go on.
It was indeed owned by MFJ. It fits perfectly with your narrative there about shaking the thing. AC2PL, just an aside. Back to net.
QFIU.
Question.
KD2SCP. Again, I also have a MFJ 949E tuner, and I love it. I've never had a problem with it. Two items from MFJ that work absolutely perfectly. Over.
Okay, very good. Like I said, there was a certain period of time where their stuff was being put together apparently by prisoners, where the quality was a little on the iffy side. So, like I said, just to be cautious, I'm a belt and suspenders sort of guy. Shake your MFG, open it up, take a good look inside, and then use it. I am not one of those people who says don't touch the stuff. So George, you wanted to say something.
Thank you, Roy. KD2FYU. My reference was to the Grandmaster meters. The Grandmaster meters for power meters and SWR meters. They're a little bit different from the league than everybody's talking about. You open these up, you're seeing something totally different. MFJ and Grandmaster were put together very many years ago. Very, very accurate, durable equipment. And the gentleman that came in earlier, the radio operator that came in earlier, mentioning that series of meter that he had, I've got to say kudos to that. Anything else I can't talk about, but the Grandmaster series of meters are excellent, excellent quality. KD2FIU, thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, George. I'm looking at MFJ's website. They don't really give that description to the MFJ 873. Maybe they've been stamping out new ones and they just dropped that nomenclature. I don't know.
Yeah, Grandmaster was a company that they bought out years ago. And I bought one maybe 5 years ago, just like the other operator mentioned. Excellent quality, very accurate.
Okay, very good. Thank you, George. Thank you, Lewis. Thank you, everyone who participated tonight. It's coming to 10:16, so I just want to remind everyone. For those people who cannot, for one reason or another, get on the repeater and wish to contact either me or Paul, Paul has his own email address, but if you want to, you can send it to me and I will bounce it off to Paul. That would be either if you have mailbag questions of the technical net, if you have topics that you'd like to hear discussed, if you'd like to share a technical puzzle. I like to try and find interesting puzzles that aren't very easily Googleable, that might lead to a better understanding of some underlying concept. So if you got puzzles like that, please share. Or, as I said before, if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have to take a look at something space-related, comment on it, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, link page. A lot of interesting articles that I didn't have a chance to get to, but they're still interesting and they're still available. You can find them on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. There's also some pictures that Paul asked me to put up that he'll be talking about during the SpaceNet report. And also, keep in mind that if you would like to listen to the repeater and you're away from your radio and you have a cell phone or anything else with internet provider service, I stream the audio of the of Glen Oaks over the internet. Just point your browser at technet.ac2gs.com and that'll give you the audio stream. And as always, want to remind people that Mike KC2NJI has a wonderful archive of technical nets that go all the way back to September of 2006 at his amateurradio.tv site. So keep that all in mind. And now I will call upon the Paul WS2N with this week's SpaceNet report.
AC2GS WS2N, very good. I doubled for a second there. I was going to tell you about the MFJ iambic here that I use, you know, for the CW. I got a model number MFJ 422B, and it's bulletproof. I'm telling you, from the late 80s, I use this thing, so it works very well. Anyway, I'll continue on here. Let me just drop it. And yes, I do have an email that I always forget to give out, but if anybody wanted to contact me directly, it's spacenetreport@gmail.com. So, okay, as far as launches and landings go, there's a few that have just taken place recently. Some successful and some not too good, but there's one in the that just went off yesterday. That's a Falcon 9 that SpaceX launched
to the International Space Station. They have a new cargo vehicle. This is the third one of that version that's going up there. Cargo vehicles, they usually go near the space station, about 50 feet away, and then they have a 57-foot robot arm that they usually grab a hold of it. The astronauts grab it, and they attach it to, they berth it to one of the ports on one of the modules. And now they've redesigned it. SpaceX now sends the cargo version up, which no longer has big solar panels that stick out. They're attached to the body of the vehicle. And they dock autonomously to the regular docking port. They don't need the robotic arm anymore. Anyway, they sent up 20 of the previous versions, and now this is the third one of the new version cargo Dragon vehicle that is resupplying the space station with a little less than 5,000 pounds of stuff was sent up on Saturday. Actually, it was late. It was Sunday morning, around 3 o'clock in the morning. So it was actually today. Anyway, that will dock with the space station tomorrow. So that's good, because they have quite a few different science experiments on that. I'll talk maybe about that in a minute. They haven't had that many launches recently. There tends to be right now an oxygen or a liquid oxygen shortage. And they say it has to do with the COVID situation. You know, worldwide, patients need, oxygen. And so it's created quite a demand, not only in the States, but worldwide. So now there tends to be a shortage. It's getting very hard and expensive for these rocket companies to get it. You know, they think nothing of putting in, a couple hundred thousand gallons of liquid oxygen, just for one launch. And month. So you could go through you could burn through a lot of liquid oxygen. Let me drop it. And I just wanted to go through the list of launches and landings, but there are no landings. But what are you gonna do? There is one I'll talk about in a minute. That's the one launched by Astra. Astra has been trying to get a rocket up into orbit for a couple of years now. But give it a minute, I'll talk about that in a second. The main topic for this evening has to do with the spacewalk, EVA, that was supposed to be done last week by two astronauts, but it was canceled due to a health-related problem. One of the astronauts on board is Mark Van de Heil. Mark Van de Heil, he's been up there before, maybe a few years ago, for like a 3-month visit to the space station. And that's the way this one was supposed to work out, but they decided to give him an extended mission. He'll be up there for almost a year, similar to what Mark Kelly did. He was the first one to make it almost a year for the United States. And also Christina Cook, she was up there for about the same amount of time. But now they're doing it again with Mark Van Hile. Now, he was supposed to go out with Akito Hoshi. He's a Japanese astronaut. He comes out of the JAXA, the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency. And by the way, he's a ham, KE5DNI, and so is Mark Van de Heil, KG5GNP. They were supposed to do a spacewalk and start setting up some brackets and things for the next ROSA, or IROSA, they call it, the rollout solar arrays that they've been putting on the space station to increase the amount of power that they can get. They had to cancel it because of he has a pinched nerve in his neck, which it must be pretty bad for them to just cancel the whole EVA. They're not really describing how bad it is. In fact, the first report was health problem. Then the next report came out that he does have this pinched nerve in the neck. And I was wondering, I was actually going to ask Dr. Roy, is he better off? I mean, it's not going to happen, but he doesn't have the choice. Is he better off? They say he's got a rest and maybe he can go out, you know, in a short period of time, you know, to eventually do that spacewalk. Is he better off resting in zero G where he is? Or, you know, if he was back on Earth, would he cure faster? Which way would you tend to get over something like that? Actually, I don't even know I didn't know you could get over something like that very easily. You know, what do they do? Take Advil and hope for the best. And so let me pass it back to Roy for a sec. But I was going to ask that during the medical part, but I don't know. It's space related, I think, right now. AC2GSWS2F.
Yeah, sure, Paul. All things being equal, if you had a really stable low G environment, it probably would be slightly more beneficial. But I don't think that that's what the ISS really amounts to. So there's a lot of other things that complicate the situation. It's basically just rest and anti-inflammatory medication. You want to stabilize the area so that it doesn't have to suffer any more strain. So all things being equal, you're probably better off on good old terra firma than zero G.
And what type of time frame, even on Earth, would the spacewalk be a week away, a month away, or, you know, are they going to eventually have to cancel it and, you know, turn it over to somebody else that has not practiced for it yet? I'm just wondering about the time frame that's involved in something like that, you know. In the neck, I guess I could, you know, throw up your arm movements and everything. It's work when they do these EVAs. They go out for sometimes 6 to 8 hours at a time. And to move their hands, it's very hard to move the gloves, very hard to, you know, because you're pressurized, you know, so you're like working inside of a balloon. So I wonder how long it would normally take, let's say, somebody on Earth to recover from that. Or maybe they don't recover. You know, back to you.
Well, again, it sort of depends on the individual. It depends upon their age. If he's relatively young, he's certainly healthy, so that's positive. But it depends upon the extent of the damage and the extent of the exertion. That's a very difficult maneuver he's planning to make. So my guess is that if it was bad enough to delay it, it's probably going to be bad enough to delay it for significantly more than a week. But that, you know, it's up to NASA. They might alter the plan so that it's a much more limited procedure. You know, there's a lot of variables that they have to ponder, and they're usually not willing to take risks because of the public relations damage it might do.
Yes, okay. Yeah, thanks for that, because, you know, you hear about these stories and they talk about, you know, to the moon, but eventually to Mars. You know, you're not going to have the option of, you know, canceling something forever if you're on the way to Mars and something has to be done. They need to do a spacewalk for some reason. So, you know, and then you wonder how this happens. You know, is it, you know, something that would have happened normally, you know, just, you know, some kind of a condition he's got, maybe some kind of, you know, narrowing of the pathway where the nerves are, you know, would it have happened on Earth? Or is it, you know, from this tremendous amount of exercise that they do on a regular basis? The astronauts are required to do 2 hours of exercise per day, and the all kinds of different, a couple of different kinds of machines. They have a jogging setup, you know. They have another thing for lifting weights, and good for your arms and legs. And I wonder, you know, they didn't say, you know, how did he do it? I mean, maybe he was doing it, you know, exercising. And now he's got to rest for who knows now. You say maybe a minimum of a week, so a couple of weeks on end. They're supposed to be exercising on a regular basis, otherwise they're losing bone mass. They're losing it anyway, but at least it slows it down. So, I'm making kind of light of this, but I think this could eventually lead to more of a problem. But we'll see as time goes on. Let me just drop it. WS2M. So, okay. We wish Mark Van der Heil well. He's quite a character. I've read a lot about him, and he's really into ham radio too. He's made quite a few contacts. Last time he was up anyway with the school, he would do school contacts. Okay, another topic I wanted to cover. Roy has put a couple of pictures on his website, and that would be the James Webb Space Telescope, literally over a decade. In fact, it used to be Dick K2RIW, one of his favorite instruments that he was hoping that was going to be put into space. He wanted to see the comparison between this telescope and Hubble, hoping that they would be in space at the same time. And it looks like he'll get his wish. It will be going up in November, and Hubble has just recently got over some really serious problems that they were able to work through. So Hubble is up and operating. But, you know, the scientists would like to get a view of something with both telescopes, and then you make a comparison. Naturally, this one with the 21-inch mirror, 21-foot mirror compared to the 8-foot mirror that Hubble has, is going to be a gigantic difference. So, the pictures I put up are what it looks like now. It's all folded up in California. Northrop Grumman is handling this project right now. And it's getting ready to be shipped. But it gives you an idea of the size of this thing, because they have technicians walking around below it. And right now it's folded up, and they're going to put it on they're going to literally ship it. They're going to float it through the Panama Canal and send it down to South America. NASA has to deal with the European Space Agency to launch the James Webb Space Telescope from their launch complex in Kourou, French Guiana. That's where the European Space Agency launches their rockets. They have light, medium, and heavy duty rockets. This is going off on the heavy version, the Ariane 5, which is a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket with two solids attached to it. That will put this thing into eventually a halo orbit, 1 million miles out away from Earth. The chances of anybody from Earth ever working on this thing in the future is nil. The Hubble is, 370 miles up. This thing will be 1 million miles up. So the distance of the moon is roughly a quarter of a million miles. This thing's going to be four times that distance from Earth. They send it to the L2 location, or Lagrange point number two. There's five Lagrange points. They have stable areas in space, which is balanced out from the different gravitational movements or pulls of planets and stars. In this case, well, it's going to Lagrange point two. One would be roughly 1 million miles away from Earth, but in the direction of the sun, so it would be in a heliocentric orbit around the sun. So it really essentially wouldn't be orbiting Earth. Earth would, and the satellite in that location would just follow around the sun. But no, this one goes to L2, which is 1 million miles in the other direction, away from the sun. So you'd have the sun, and then you have the it'd be Earth and then the satellite 1 million miles away. Earth would be in the middle. So it'd be a centrifugal motion around the sun combined with the pull of the gravity of Earth and the sun. That establishes that 1 million mile location point, and they call it Lagrange point two. So that's where this thing's going to be located. It's going to take roughly a month to get there. Once it launches in November, you know, they're not just going to get pictures of, you know, of galaxies far, far away. They're going to have to wait roughly a month. This thing will, you know, first, you know, it start opening up slowly. They have different pyrotechnics, different explosion devices on the James Webb Space Telescope, and it's roughly 80, a little over 80 different things that have to be separated and opened up to completely transform this thing from, you know, inside essentially a small, well, it's a big bearing on top. You know, anybody that's listened to this, that before or read about this, I'm sure they've heard this before, but if you haven't, it's pretty amazing. This thing is going to unfurl, and you're going to have five different layers of insulation. This fabric, this Mylar fabric, one on top of the other, and that's going to be roughly the size of this tennis court. And the idea is to keep a it's going to create a shade. It's going to be, that part's going to be facing the sun and the earth. They don't want any infrared heat coming off the earth or even the moon, especially the sun, to hit the 21-foot mirror. This is mostly an infrared testing telescope that they need to keep as cold as possible down to as close to absolute zero as possible. I think it does get down to around 3.5 degrees Kelvin at the coldest point with the setup. It actually has a system to even lower the temperature even more. I think it can operate around 7 or 8 degrees Kelvin, but then they lowered it even more for the finest viewing that the telescope will be doing. So it should be interesting. Like I said, it's going to take almost a month to completely unfurl. And they all have to, everything has to happen just right. It's got an electronic type of gyroscope system on it. It's got naturally solar panels for power. It does have thrusters to move it in space. Every once in a while, it will have to, reorient its location in space to keep it in its halo orbit. Orbit, you really don't need much power, but once in a while you need to do something so it doesn't drift off. And we'll see how this works. It was supposed to originally be launched in 2017, and delay after delay, and they tested problems, this Mylar ripped. One thing after the other, but they eventually got it all straightened out. This communications that they worked out, there was some kind of interference going on at one point during the test. Anyway, this thing has worked out. They've shaked it, they froze it down to nothing, and hopefully James Webb gets to its proper location, and that would be like our new Hubble. Because Hubble's not going to last forever, that's for sure. And there's no more service missions going up to it. We don't have the shuttle to do that. And the Hubble did have five service missions right from the beginning. It needed one when the mirror was found to be manufactured incorrectly, and they corrected it with other onboard optics that they brought up to the Hubble to straighten it out. And since then, there's been repair after repair, replacement of computers, replacement of gyros, replacement of all kinds of stuff. Solar panels, they threw them away and put on smaller ones that were just as powerful. But eventually it's going to quit. The last flight up there was, 2008, 2009, and they were hoping to get 7 years after that, but they've gotten a lot more. So we'll see. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet.
KD2FIU.
Hi, George. How are you?
Hi, Paul. I'm doing okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming back. Great report, as you always go with. Any idea what mode and what frequencies of communications they're having with these modules out there? I don't expect them to be working the ones that we're working with as ham radio operators, but are we looking at like maybe 800 megahertz, 1, 2 gig, 5 gig, 10 gig, whatever? But the smaller the frequency, the shorter it goes. But do you have any idea what mode and what frequency we're communicating with these modules?
Any of the deep space modules, George, were usually X-band. When they go out that far, that's what they use, which is, I think it's 8.4 gig? Well, anyway, it's in the 8 gig or the X-band range. And they communicated with that, with Voyager. Now that's still operating. That was launched, 1977. Again, that's full X-band. And by the way, that's how they know how far these things are away. That signal is received and then back. And this, all in the time within, I think, 6 inches or so, how Voyager is away, using the frequencies, for the radio. Pretty amazing. The optics, I'm going to talk about that later, but I had time with another spacecraft that's being developed that will be launched not too long from now, called Psyche. Psyche will be going out to an asteroid also named Psyche. So they named the spacecraft after the asteroid. And that's going to have optical communications. But it'll have both. It'll be on the X-band and optical as well. They've already experimented with optical from the... They sent spacecraft in orbit around the moon about 10 years ago, called LOTI, and that had an optical system on board just to see how it worked, that you could really increase the bandwidth. But to make a long story short, it's really X-band. Back to you, George.
Thank you. Your answer is great. Thank you very much. WS2N, KD2FIU. Yeah, I got it right where you were mentioning the 8 gig. Okay, thanks, Paul.
Okay, George, very good. And let's see, let me just move on to these new types of satellites that they are developing, called DiskSats. They haven't launched any yet, but they're developing it. I think the first batch they could probably launch within a year and a half if they get the acceptance from somebody to launch these things. Popular satellites that go up are CubeSats, and CubeSats have been launched. I think the earliest one was actually a ham sat called Dove, before the millennium started. And since then, there's literally been hundreds of these things developed by mostly colleges. Up on rod share missions with, you know, big satellites, and they'll send these things up, and these are relatively small. One CubeSat is usually, naturally it's shaped like a cube, and there are 10 centimeters in, length, height, width, which puts it around 10 centimeters, roughly 4-inch cubes. Some experiments that the college helped send up involve more electronics, more this, more that. And they'll put two cubes together, and each one is called a U, or for unit. So you might have a three U CubeSat, three of them put together. You had two of them that followed a spacecraft all the way to Mars. It followed the spacecraft to Mars, and those two spacecraft were called Marco. And they were about the size of a suitcase, but, they had, I think there were 12 CubeSats, put together to make electronics and communications and power supply and all of that, navigation. Now, this one company, Aerospace Corp, is developing something called DISC-SATs, D-I-S-K, SATs. And they look like, a big, disc, but, here in diameter. And roughly about an inch. 2.5 centimeters, so an inch or so in thick. And on one side of the disc, it would be covered with solar panels, solar cells. And this way they could still, create a lot of power, with something that is roughly 3 feet in diameter, you're going to get like 200 watts out of it. No problem. In Earth orbit, naturally. Mars orbit, you start to get involved with the inverse square law. You start going from 200 watts down to 60 watts or something real quick. But even any of experiments, so DISC-SATs, they can stack one on top of platters that they used to use for LP records or something. Just stack them and put them in a fairing spacecraft and launch them into space. Instead of dozens of these CubeSats, you can launch that. So they were already working with Peter Beck. He's the CEO of Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab has been launching rockets now for a few years. So they're basing it on that. Right now, the diameter of that is roughly meter, fairings on Rocket Lab's Electron rocket. Be surprised, in like a year, you'll see these things launch and they'll be tested. Now, like I said, but the other side, you can have communications. And they're getting better and better with phased arrays, so you can probably have a flat bottom. A lot of these new phased array systems are starting to use. So your cube to have some kind of path to open up to kind of a large area for solar panels. It would have to have some other kind of gadget to deploy antennas to the disk. Any mechanism be solar panels, the other side would be communication. Already built moving parts to get them operating. So I thought that was interesting, and I thought I'd bring it up before I move the comments. Talking about the CubeSat. It was called the deorbital craft. Millennium Space is developing these are CubeSats now. They're developing a system to be able to deorbit these things sooner and eventually larger spacecraft as well. With little think so. Not eventually. If you just say keep it up, you know, you would want them to, well, let's say a college that built it, their experiment is done, you don't need it anymore, let's deorbit this instead of leaving it up there. Company sent up, they sent up two CubeSats, identical CubeSats, and an experiment. One of them has no, just a CubeSat, just going to stay in orbit. The other one has this tether that will unfurl, or did unfurl. And it's long, so I can't imagine the mechanism that this, meter line out of it. So it's a long 70 meter line facing Earth. Eventually that starts picking up, there was in near Earth orbit, a couple hundred miles up. Over time, any satellite will deorbit. But they compared the difference between the two, and it was, like I said, the drag race is set up that was launched by at the exact same time. How long it would take, they figured out that this one just came down the other day in only 8 months with the 70 meter tether pointing toward Earth. And it deorbited and marked up in space. But the other one's still going, and they estimate that will be up there for at least 7 years. The difference between 8 months and 7 years. So they've been working on this idea for a couple of companies anyway. This one has proven that it works in their design.
KD2FIU.
On larger satellites and have long things sticking out of it, long tethers, eventually unfurl them and get these things out of, when they're done being used. SpaceX, for instance, they have literally over 1,000 now, I think 1,600 communication wideband satellites up there that have to deorbit, and they are depending on, one or two things. If it fails, completely fails, they know it will eventually deorbit from its roughly 300-mile orbit. But they also use the Hall thrusters, so if they know it's no good, there's something wrong with it, they can easily deorbit their satellites. But what would happen, over time, everything failed, would they be able to, unfurl a tether to deorbit these things? So it might be a good backup to install on every satellite that goes up. We've made tons of garbage here on Earth. There's garbage dumps all over the place. We don't need to continue that in low Earth orbit. Any comments? WS1. Okay. Not too long ago, Jeff Bezos from Amazon fame, who also owns Blue Origin, a space company, he went up with three other people, his brother, some odd-year-old woman, and an 18-year-old guy from the Netherlands. They went up together in a suborbital spacecraft called New Shepard. That is actually now ready to start accepting more passengers, more paying passengers, and that was the way it was originally designed to do, and the capability now. So I thought, well, okay, they just went up. They'll probably do it again very shortly. But no, they launched another unmanned one with different experiments on board, unmanned experiments, different people, maybe even NASA, who are paying to run these experiments on flight. So it says, it launched properly. The spacecraft itself separated, even so there was nobody in it. That came down on parachutes. and the boost that went up came down vertically, just the way it took off, and landed vertically using its one PE3 liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. So I guess eventually they will start sending up people. I mean, they didn't give a time frame for that. I don't know what the big rush was with Jeff Bezos, I guess maybe to compete with the other guy flying Virgin Galactic, Richard Branson. But, anyway, commercial suborbital flight stands for this. I really should have gotten to the Astra's company that's trying to get their rocket. They have a real fancy name for their rocket. It's called Rocket. They're the Rocket 3.0 version, 3.1, 3.2, 3.3. And the first two that they tried to send into space failed. Didn't make it too far from the launch pad. They eventually self-destructed it, came back down to Earth. No one went a lot further. But eventually they sent the signal and self-destructed that one as well. It's launching from a complex that they bring out to the location for launching these rockets by Astra is in Alaska. They call it the Kodiak launch complex. Now it's called the Pacific Launch Complex or something. Yeah, anyway, they're launching it from Alaska, and this one was a new and improved version of the rocket that failed twice, and it's had an extended tank, so it has more fuel, better guidance. Anyway, it's got five small, relatively small engines compared to something like what SpaceX would launch. They have nine large engines. These are small ones. They're not. This rocket. They'll let every booster burn up and go into the water. The idea is to launch very inexpensive launches, for paying customers. Probably mostly the military. I think they're looking to launch military satellites from Kodiak, Alaska. Very easy over the poles. So, this one they tested out. I saw a replay on. Now this just happened yesterday. They launched off the. They got 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. They launch off the launch pad. And a second later, the whole thing starts tilting over,
complete.
Multiple degrees out of vertical. But the rocket engines are going, in an odd direction. Then eventually it starts to straighten itself up, but it's going up, it's going vertically, but it's also going horizontally. And then it really starts to take off. Power really kicked in, and sure enough, it started to go, what looked like it was going to go into space. It got up to around 50 kilometers, which is roughly 30 miles or so, and what a booster separates from the payload. I have a camera on the payload, and the booster, you could see, it was going up. Looking back at Earth, you can see Earth down below. You can see Alaska in the distance. And the next thing you see it start to see this thing tumbling. First you see the Earth, then you don't see the Earth, and it starts tumbling over and over again. So they, sure enough, they had to hit the destruct button, and mission control is in California, so they destroyed another one. But they say they have another one ready, and they're going to look into what went wrong. They know they had a burnout on one of the engines, five engines, one of them burnt out. but they have to look at the why, how come, and try to fix this. But there's many companies trying to do this, a few other ones that I'm not going to get to, but this is just another one to launch small payloads, maybe 300-500 pounds. Some of them have dreams of building bigger rockets where you can get maybe 3,000 pounds up or something. But that's the story. Any comments, questions before I turn it over to Roy? Not really much coming up. There is one flight coming up, not too far from now. We'll be eventually another crew going to the International Space Station. Another crew of four. So right now we have 7 on board, and eventually there'll be 12 on board when that thing launches. And they'll leave it like that for a week or so, and then the other four will come back. The good news for me, anyway, is, for any of us, is that the next one going up will also have two amateur radio astronauts on board. Half the crew will be ham radio operators. I have the call signs and everything, but we'll talk about that more next week, or maybe when I get ready for launch, probably about a month or so. Turning back to Roy, let me drop it for 1 second.
KD2FIU.
And we'll just turn it back to you. I'll be on tomorrow night. Tomorrow night we have the Limar Club InfoNet that always comes on at 8:30, not 8 o'clock like this net does, but 8:30. And then that's always followed by Flopper Chop by George. You heard George before, by you. Does a great job on Flopper Chop, and then we have the Newsline after that. Roy, over to you, AC2GS. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
Yeah, Paul, I think George wanted to ask you or tell you something.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear anybody key up. Back to you, George.
WS2N, KD2FIU, thank you. And thank you, Roy. And, you know, it reminds me, the way you're describing all of the new efforts beyond NASA's capabilities within the private corporation capabilities, it reminds me of efforts on the Bonneville Salt Flats 60 years ago with the efforts to create engines and speeds on ground level. However, we're doing this into space. Thank you for all the reporting, KD2FIU.
Okay. I drove out west a couple of times. I remember passing the Bonneville Salt Flats and imagining Gary Breedlove traveling at, I guess, 644 miles an hour. I don't know. I probably have that number wrong, but something like that, flying along that place. That must have been something. I still think they do it once in a blue moon. Okay, George, thanks for the comments, and we'll turn it back to Roy, AC2GS, WS2N.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do here and in the club in general. Once again, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. I hope we all learned a few things, shared a few things. And I hope most of you, if not all of you, will come back next Sunday when we'll try and do it all over again. As always, I'd like to add these technical nets with a bit of wisdom from K2RIW, Dick, who ran this technical net for 38 plus years. He would often end the technical net with the advice of everyone to be kind to each other. As I've said before, and will no doubt say again, that's good advice in general. That's very good advice these days. We still live in dangerous times. Be safe. Be smart. Read up on stuff. Don't take people's anecdotal stories as facts. Don't take horse parasite pills. Don't take industrial bleach. Listen to doctors. They've trained and spent their lives trying to figure this out. If you can and you haven't, get a vaccine. If your loved ones or friends or family or neighbors urge them to get the vaccine. It's only through the vaccine and social distancing that we're going to get rid of this plague upon us. I wish you all a happy and safe week. Be well, and please try to